Hello and welcome to this podcast sponsored by Columbia Threadneedle Investments. I'm Richard Lander of Citywire, and today we're going to look at how and whether active investing can be delivered at low cost in a way that allows financial planners to meet the needs of their clients. And joining me to discuss this are two experts, Keith Barmer, who is a portfolio manager with Columbia Threadneedle in their multi-asset investment team. And also with us is Chris Bull, a chartered financial planner at Kellens in Cheshire. So welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining us. Keith, let's start with you, and let's start discussing your universal range of funds. Very briefly, what do they do?
What do they do? Well, very simplistically, we have a range. So the universal funds is a range of risk-rated products that are trying to deliver the highest amount of performance possible, given a certain amount of risk tolerance. What we're trying to do is we're trying to achieve that performance through active management, but very importantly, keep those costs low so it's still very attractive for advisors such as Chris and other people across the country to have them for their clients.
So low cost and active is a bold combination. What was the thinking behind you doing this?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, you have to go back to probably sort of 2012 when RDR came in, and you saw a big shift. So lots and lots of changes to the advice process, the unbundling of costs. It meant to say that in that particular moment, what you had was much, much greater focus on costs in terms of that advice process. If you then looked at what the subsequent changes were to that advice process, what you saw was that advisors moved away from active management into cheaper solutions, and those cheaper solutions were generally or almost exclusively passive-based solutions. So we looked, and there's a very, very well-known range of funds which is passive out there. They don't do any active asset allocation. They only use benchmark products, and that was by far the best-selling product range out there for this particular market. And we thought, well, if that's the best-selling product that's out there, I think given the advantages that we have in terms of the active asset allocation, stock selection, then we can deliver better performance. But you've just got to be very careful because you can't price it significantly different. So if you can do that, then it means to say that you can have effectively offer something to advisors which is going to be attractive, not just for them, but also for their clients. You've got a good chance as long as you put really, really good top investment talent to work in that, of delivering on that outsized performance.
So presumably you would have done a bit of market research, talked to advisors before launching this range.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. So we have a long heritage in working with advisors across the country. And that allowed us to have, a few different advantages. One of them was that we could start with a blank piece of paper. Secondly, we knew what advisors actually wanted or needed to fit into that advice process. And because you're starting from that blank piece of paper, you can actually then build it to fit exactly that advice process. So if we can make it as easy as possible for advisors, then it means to say you're more likely to use us.
Right. So turning to you, Chris, what sort of feedback were you giving Keith in terms of how they might shape this range of funds?
There's a few things that are important when we're thinking about the sort of solutions we want to use for our clients. Whilst cost is part of that, and it's an important part that has certainly come more into focus throughout the years, you want to know that you trust the solution. So it's broad, it's diversified, it can be realised easily. Clients aren't going to become stuck in it. The risk control that Keith mentioned in terms of having confidence of how it's going to behave in different market conditions. You know, as we've seen in recent years, they will be tested and we have to learn to trust the solutions. So it's quite a broad range of considerations we're looking at. And if it can be wrapped up in a solution that prices well, then that's the ideal from our perspective.
Okay. And how much of this reflects how life has changed for a company like yours over the last 15 years?
It slots in really neatly. Over the years, the advice has become more technical. Financial planning as an industry has really evolved and moved on, which is fantastic. And also technology, which really helps us deliver our solutions, has enabled us to plug into some fantastic institutional type investments. And if we can introduce the likes of a multi-asset fund, such as the Universal Range, that just plugs in very nicely through what is an ever-evolving landscape.
What about you, Keith? How's life been changing for asset management firms?
Yeah, I think if you look at the asset management industry as a whole, you've now got a few different options. So if you take the corollary through in terms of that, cost is becoming a much, much more critical factor in that advice process. I think there is such an overwhelming focus on costs from clients moving up into the advisors and advisors onto the product choice. We went starting from that blank piece of paper and being able to go, okay, so what do we need to do? And it's just active management at a passive price point. So I think that is the way that you're going to go forward. We were lucky we didn't have that existing book of business that you had to shrink the margins on. We still want to have that outperformance, which is why we have all of those different levers in place. So we have the ability to outperform your average and do a little bit better than that. But if you keep the costs low, it means to say that if you do that well, and you can't do that with you can't put your sort of, you know, second best manager or your third best manager in, you've got to put your best investment capabilities in. If you do that, it becomes less of a story. It becomes more of a reality where you get good performance, attractive cost, which means to say more people will invest into your products. And if you get to that critical mass, which it doesn't work at small AUMs, but if you can do that, you've got much more chance of getting that critical AUM to allow you to actually be it being accretive from a business perspective, but also it's accretive from the underlying financial advisors and they're most importantly, the underlying clients. And if they're happy, then you're going to be happy.
Right. I mean, one thing that's happened is now you have more and more ways of offering solutions to clients, DFMs, MPSs, and so on. What are the qualities that particularly stood out in adopting something like Universal for you against these alternatives?
Yeah, determining which of those solutions is right in many respects depends on the client. And, you know, a DFM solution, if someone's got, they want to bespoke certain aspects or there's some form of tax management, absolutely fine. There's a space. For a lot of our clients, what we were finding was it was about the construct of a great financial plan and doing that job very, very well, and then plugging into solutions that are well managed that help deliver that plan. So moving through on into the likes of things like MPS versus like a unitized multi-asset fund, it's really trying to understand what a client's looking for. Because if you're going to introduce more cost into the equation, it's making sure that they're actually going to benefit as a result of that. And there's that sort of attractive quality of a fund of funds type approach, which intuitively looks nice on a platform. But actually, if you can deliver on a client's objectives in something that is actually very well built, very well diversified and well managed, and the costs come down through a unitized solution, that plays really nicely into what we try and do.
Okay, so it's generally more tax efficient, a solution like this?
The tax helps. I mean, we're working across all sorts of different wrappers, and sometimes that'd be more relevant than others. But probably more fundamental than the tax would be, I think being unitized just helps the fund to be quite nimble in a way that more of a traditional sort of discretionary type approach, it's a slower ship to turn. I don't know if you think that's fair, Keith, but just that tactical overlay that is very evident within the Universal range is certainly afforded through the unitization.
Cool. Keith, let's just come back to you. Just dive a little into the mechanics of the fund. It's one thing to say we're going to do a low-cost range of funds. It's another thing to do it. So how do you do it and keep those costs as low as you have done?
Yeah, I think the starting point is this is what we've been doing for many, many years with our institutional client base. So I don't think we're doing anything particularly radical here. What we're doing is we're just bringing across the institutional thought process in terms of how to construct a portfolio, and I'll go into that in a little bit. But also bring across the price point from the institutional world. So it sounds like it's a radical idea. Certainly 7 years ago, it sounded very radical. But I don't think it actually was. So what do you mean by an institutional mindset? Well, what you've got to do when you put a portfolio together is you've got to understand how do you have give yourself the greatest opportunity to add value into a portfolio, i.e. be average. So one of the areas that you can go is, okay, so let's, how are we going to construct it from the bottom up? So do we use benchmark-aware products, i.e. passive investments, ETFs, or do you use underlying investment capabilities where you've got active stock selection going on? Well, if you're happy with average, well, choose an ETF. But I think, and really I think our role as an asset manager is to not be happy with average. What we should be striving for is above average. And the good news is at Columbia Threadneedle, we have incredibly good investment talent. And so therefore, I can have that. Now, I know they're not going to, every single manager isn't going to outperform every single day. But over time, and that's exactly what we've seen over the past 7 years, they've added significant benefit in terms of stock selection. So I'm now not getting slightly above average returns. And then on top of that, I've got to think of the sort of the bigger things that move markets. So what's going to happen in terms of where you're on the economic cycle? Clearly, if you are in a period of growth, then what you want to be is you want to have your portfolios biased towards your more risk-based assets. But if you're in a period of low growth or concerns over growth, then probably you want to be biased more towards your safer havens, such as your government bonds. So these are sort of very slow-moving, longer-term moving dynamics. So therefore, your process has to be understanding about that. And that's where your strategic asset allocation comes in. So if you just set it and then don't do anything, well, that's going to be great on average once again. But actually, you should be able to achieve a little bit better returns if you move your portfolios in line with the economic cycle. So we do the strategic asset allocation on a quarterly basis. The reason we do it on a quarterly basis, which is probably a little bit more frequent than we see out there in the marketplace as the most common way of doing it, is really because although you are basing it on long-term fundamentals, well, the price changes quite radically through the year. So they or can change quite radically through the year. And I'll give you an example of that one. So if you think of either the pandemic, so if you think about 31st December 2019, pretty much everything was expensive. So equities are expensive and government bonds and credit was expensive. By the time we got to the 31st of March, so that's sort of just after the bottom of the markets, then you suddenly had equities that were cheap and government bonds, which were extortionately expensive. So at which point you probably want to have a different portfolio, even though you're basing it on long terms. Or a long-term forecast. But then you've got to have something else that works because things don't always move so slowly. And we've had some great examples of that. And, you know, Trump coming in, getting elected. You've had the UK budget. All these sort of factors coming into play. And these are much more short-term dynamics in markets where there's opportunities. And those opportunities are either risks or there's a chance for higher returns, higher reward. So on that point, you need to have a faster moving system, and that's where our tactical asset allocation comes in. So these are small little adjustments to your long-term foundation, which is your strategic asset allocation, which allows you or equips you to, so for example, once again, going back to the pandemic, you know, going into that pandemic, you didn't want to wait a quarter before you took risk off the table. And so therefore, that allowed us to get in much more quickly, take risk off and achieve a better return for our clients. So it's a combination of all of those three different areas where you've got long-term strategic asset allocation, shorter-term tactical asset allocation, and combine that with underlying bottom-up stock selection. That gives us lots and lots of levers to add value into the portfolios. And then once again, you've just got to price it at the right thing. So you don't, it's not you, the asset manager, that's keeping all of that alpha and outsized performance. You're giving that back to clients. And if the clients get it, then clearly everyone's a winner.
Happy days.
I mean, from an advice perspective, that's exactly what you want to hear, because we want to be forming long-term plans that are in the right portfolios to deliver on that. Whether the likes of Keith are actually, you know, working to look at the opportunity, the risks out there, and make adjustments over time. So just trying to add the extra boost into a client's portfolio. So if you can marry the two, that's where it works, and that's really what we look for.
So just Keith, just give us a little sort of insight into what is in one of those funds. I think when we discussed before, you said there's not much ETFs in there, but just tell us what ETFs are in there and what other investments are in there.
Yeah, so you don't want to be too constrained in terms of your thought process, but the way that we find is best way of delivering that alpha, that return to clients, is directly held securities. So if you look through the portfolios, you would see somewhere around about 150 to 200 individual equities. It's clearly not buying everything in the index. I mean, in something like a MSCI World, you've got 1,500 different securities. So we're not just buying everything. And we're certainly not doing it in a market cap aware way. We're choosing the individual securities that we want to have, that we think have got the best opportunity of outsized gains. And then on the fixed income side, we do have more diversification. Once again, bonds are very different to equities insofar that my upside to bonds is I get my money back and all of the...
hopefully.
That's the upside. The upside is that you do get your money back and then and you get all of the promised money from before, you know, in the form of coupons. That's going to come through. That's your upside. Your downside is you get the default and you don't get all of your money back. So you have a slightly different proposition. So you want to have more diversification inside your government, inside your fixed income part of your portfolio. So if you look through there, you're probably looking at somewhere around about 600 individual bonds. That would be spanning all the credit range. So from high yield through to investment grade and government bonds at the top of that. So highly diversified, individual positions. Now, what I then want to do is I want to minimize my transaction costs. I want to minimize my friction on the markets. So when going back to talking about those tactical positions, which can be, you know, as short as we've ever had a tactical position on is a couple of days, which is incredibly short for us. But typically you'll be expecting a few months. But if you've got those sort of positions on and you're going to be sort of putting them on and then taking them off very shortly afterwards, if you're not careful, you're going to be incurring a huge amount of transaction costs. So for those, we generally use derivatives. So these are just things like an S&P future. So if we think US is a good place to be, which is what we do at the moment, we'll add a little bit extra in terms of an S&P futures contract. Cheapest chips to get in, cheapest chips to get out. That allows us to have short-term positions without much friction on the market. So once again, the clients get most of that benefit instead of us always chopping and changing the portfolio. So in brief, you've got about 1,000 positions, give or take, within the portfolio, split across typically directly held securities, but there'll be a small portion of futures contracts and occasionally some options. So if we want to put a bit of convexity into the portfolios, so if we want to hold, say, a long-term position in equities, but we're concerned there might be a bit of a pullback because markets have got a little bit too rich, well, we can put some options in there to try and benefit from that as well.
All right. I mean, Chris, so that is the portfolio. That's the sort of makeup of them. Is this an easy range to explain to your clients?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've worked with such a range of different types of clients, from expert investment professionals to people who are far less familiar. And what you've got is a very clear set of objectives in terms of what each fund is trying to do within the range. You know, sort of an inflation plus type return with a clear risk mandate. So from that perspective, it maps in so easily. It's quite straightforward. When you're sort of going up the scale towards more experienced investors, then actually I think it plays quite well, because you've got the clear spread in terms of how they're going about doing things between that strategic and tactical asset allocation, how these security selections playing through in a very clean way that I think experienced investors really quite like. They understand it. It's clear. It's not multi-layered. Then if you're really into sort of expert investors, then that's where they're really sort of testing things in terms of how you're accessing different types of securities when you're holding, say, direct shares and bonds. It's a challenge I think I've put to you before, Keith, in terms of you're not holding direct exposures in perhaps other asset classes. And that's where it's quite clever when you can bring in actually the types of securities you're buying are giving you that diversification without owning that extra asset type. So it's been really, really well tested right across the range of different clients. And generally, we found it just very well received.
And do you mainly use this as a one-stop shop, or do you put it, for some clients, is it part of a wider mix?
Yeah, our starting point is to have a blend, albeit... what we do as an organisation is we blend perhaps a few solutions which on their own could serve to manage an entirety of a client's wealth. But if we build a few together, then it just lets us access a range of different styles and just have a bit more diversification. So very much a core part of our portfolio, but we're not trying to sort of build our own asset allocation around these sorts of solutions. We'd view it as a holding that could exist as a standalone that we might add to with a few other portfolios for that extra spread.
And how important in choosing a solution like this is service? I mean, obviously you want the performance, but are you getting the service that you need?
Service is so fundamental, and it comes down to trust. We need to know how funds are being managed, so in terms of how they will react in different environments, because we don't want to get caught out. Markets will have bad years. We just don't know when they're going to arrive. And when they do roll around, we want solutions to behave in a way that we've led our clients to expect. And that's where the service element is really fundamental. It's about good communication in the good times and the bad. And then also keeping our knowledge up, you know, in terms of the funds that we're recommending, so that we're confident that we can explain that to clients and that we are delivering services and solutions that we are fully up to speed with. So it needs to be a partnership in many respects.
I'll say that it's nice to hear that it's sort of coming through, and obviously every financial advisor we deal with has slightly different requirements or needs, and we try to commit to as much of that as possible. So you know, there's the regular sort of generic correspondence that goes out. We try and give views on a weekly basis in terms of what's been going on in the world through little videos done by our chief economist. But then we also want to make sure that it's not just about the product, and it can never be just about the product. We've got to give something outside of that as well, because there's some very, very good asset managers out there. And so therefore, we have another thing. So it's not just everything about the product or the macro environment that we're in, but it's also we have a service called Advisor Edge, and this is technical training. Now, this is not my expertise at all, but this is where some other people inside our organization will happily go along and talk about different technical aspects which will help out a financial advisor such as Kellen's or other people. And that is a non-paid for, so that comes at for free. It is hopefully to try and increase the education and the effectiveness of financial advisors, and they can tailor it to their own side. So if you just go out, push product and just sell products, at some point, it's not going to work. It's not going to be useful. You've got to be as useful as you possibly can in as many aspects as you possibly can to a financial advisor, because then you've got much more loyalty, trust, understanding, and so therefore they're less likely to make a bad decision or a rash decision, as far as we're concerned. I think I'm going around in circles here, but effectively, what we want to do is be a holistic provider.
Right. Before we wrap up, let's just turn to what the funds are situated to do looking forward over the next year. So I'm not going to ask you for S&P 500 predictions. You'll be happy to know. But it really is terribly fluid at the moment. We've just had a revolution in a Middle Eastern country, which no one dreamt about even 2 weeks ago. We've had a surprise result in the US election, I think, for a lot of people. And, you know, someone who can be called all sorts of names, but unpredictable is probably the politest. These things are happening very rapidly. Let's start with you. How are you set up for what looks like to be a very uncertain year going forward?
Yeah, look, this is sort of the fun part of my job, and this is sort of what we're paid for. If you look back, so I know your question is about today going forward, but if you look back over the past 7 years since we started, you look at what we've had, and I believe the phrase is we've had a pretty tough paper round. You probably wouldn't have wanted to start your fund 7 years ago, because we've had a pandemic, so that we've had recessions, we've had inflation being incredibly high, we've had inflation being low, we've had interest rates at zero, we've had interest rates, the fastest rate rises you've had. So you've sort of had all the different market conditions that you could ever want. And the good news is that active management has worked. I mean, it hasn't been perfect at all times, because we don't have, you know, perfect foresight. But generally, we've been able to move the portfolios around in the most appropriate manner, given that individual situation. So where are we now? Well, you know, President Trump, I should say, has got into power, but he hasn't yet got the full reins. So we've got to wait until January to find out how much of the rhetoric that he's been spouting so far is actually going to come to fruition. So it is a situation which is pretty fluid. It can be very volatile, or it could be actually quite simple. It could just be a continuation. I don't think he's going to be a continuation candidate, but it could be just a continuation of where we've been before. Prior to the election, for us, it was a 50-50 call. Clearly, when it's first past the post, then it's very easy to know that, well, clearly one person's going to win and one person's not. We just didn't know who it was going to be. So we didn't do anything beforehand. But following the election, the results, when everything was known, and clearly it was going to be, well, clearly in our view, and has turned out to be that way with the markets, is, you know, the US was going to be fairly beneficial. So it's going to be good for equities, particularly with the clean sweep that you saw that the Republicans had. It's going to be good for equities, and it's generally going to be bad for government bonds. And that's what we saw. It's going to be good for the US dollar. It's going to be bad for emerging markets. So there are lots and lots of Trump trades that are out there. But we didn't do anything beforehand because we thought we were pretty well positioned. We didn't have any significant risks for either candidate. So if either candidate got in, we didn't think that we were going to have a significant downside. But then post the election, once we were aware of that, then we moved our overweight position, which we had to Europe. We moved that across into the US. So Europe was clearly going to be affected by the tariffs, in our view. So moved that across to the US, which was going to get a boost. That's exactly what's happened. We had a hedge on against a stronger pound against the dollar. That wasn't going to work out very well against... we had a hedge on against a stronger pound against the dollar. And so therefore... we took that off because our view was that the dollar was going to get stronger. But we also had a view that, or we had a hedge on in place against the euro getting weaker against sterling. And that's been absolutely fine. So we've kept those on. So small little changes across the portfolio. And we'll wait to see what Mr. Trump does when he's inaugurated in. Now, if that's a radical difference to how the market is expecting him to act, well, we'll change our portfolio accordingly. But I'm not going to try and second guess this man because, as you said, he's a pretty unpredictable fellow. And so therefore, if you're 50% of the time you're right and 50% of the time you're wrong, you probably don't want to put too much on that trade.
You might as well just go down the casino and Correct. Stick it all on red.
Exactly.
That always works out well. Chris, just to wrap up from your point of view, you know, what sort of feedback are you getting from clients? Are they anxious or they just say, this is why we pay you, please just get on with your job?
Well... there's just an enormous need for advice out there. And the UK election has been perhaps more determining of that with the recent budget. So from our perspective, it's very much about, you know, focusing on the long-term plans, adapting as we need to, given recent events. And whether it's a US election or events in the Middle East, or whatever it might be that comes around, there'll always be major events, noise out there in markets. From our perspective, it's very much a case of having solid, well-built long-term plans that clients can trust, knowing that money's being properly managed in the background.
Brilliant. Keith Balmer of Columbia Threadneedle and Chris Bull from Kellens, thank you very much for joining us.